What's up, podcast family, and welcome to another episode of the L3 Leadership Podcast, where we are obsessed with helping you grow to your maximum potential and to maximize the impact of your leadership. My name is Doug Smith, and I am your host, and today's episode is brought to you by my good friends at Henny Jewelers. They are my jeweler of choice, and if you are in need of a good jeweler, check them out at hennyjewelers.com. In today's episode, you are in for a real treat. You're going to hear my interview with Jeremy Pryor, co-founder of Family Teams. This is a ministry that I just discovered earlier this year, actually as a result of another interview that I did with Brad Cooper. And this ministry, Family Teams, has changed my life, my wife's life, and our family's life. And listen, this episode is all about leading your family and leaders. We need to lead our families well. And I believe Family Teams can give you the tools to do that. So get ready for that. And if you're new to the podcast, welcome. We are so glad you're here. And if you've been listening to us for a while and this episode or our podcast has made an impact on your life, it would mean the world to me if you would share it with others and leave us a rating and review on iTunes. That really does help us grow our audience and add value to more leaders. So thank you in advance for that. And I wanted to let you know that currently at L3 Leadership, we are looking for and recruiting mastermind facilitators. One of the five things we do is we have mastermind groups that meet, and these are intentional groups of leaders that meet together for an entire year, every 2 weeks, and the whole purpose of the group is to go through life together and to challenge each other and hold each other accountable for going after our goals. I've been in mastermind groups for over 6 years. It's changed my life. I've been leading mastermind groups for over 6 years. That's changed my life. And so if you're listening to this and you want to be a leader of leaders, if you want to make an impact in leaders' lives and also grow yourself, I want to encourage you and challenge you to become an L3 Mastermind Facilitator. It's super easy. We will train you. We will give you everything you need to lead your group. And in fact, we will also compensate you. You actually make commission off of your group. So if you're interested in leading an L3 Mastermind group, go to l3leadership.org/lead. Again, that's l3leadership.org/lead. And with that being said, let me just tell you a little bit more about Jeremy before we dive into this interview. I mentioned this earlier, but I was interviewing Brad Cooper at an earlier episode of the podcast, and he said, hey, me and my family have been following Family Teams to a T, and it's changed our family. And so I looked up Family Teams and saw Jeremy, and he had a book called Family Revision, and I bought it, and my wife and I read it, and it transformed the way that we view family and lead our family, and it's changed everything. And so when Jeremy agreed to doing an interview, I could not be more excited because I had so many questions I wanted to ask him. And so you're going to learn a ton about leading your family. And leader, I am telling you, if you lead your family, you need to listen to this episode. So listen to it with your spouse. And after you listen to it, make sure you connect with Family Teams, because I believe it can transform the trajectory of your family's life. So with that being said, let's dive right into the interview. Enjoy my interview with Jeremy Pryor, and I'll be back at the end with a few announcements. Well, hey, Jeremy, thank you so much for being willing to do this interview. I've been looking forward to this for a while, and I'm just excited to learn from you. And for those of you who may not know who Jeremy is, Jeremy, can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah. Hey, Doug. So good to be here. Yeah. So my name is Jeremy. I live in Northern Kentucky, grew up in the Seattle area, have five kids. Me and my wife met in Jerusalem. And ever since, we've been trying to figure out what is God's blueprint for family. So a big part of what we do is a thing called Family Teams. And we're a pretty entrepreneurial family. We start a bunch of companies. And so between kind of our ministry here locally, our Family Teams organization, and some of the other companies, that takes up a lot of our time.
Yeah. Can you just give a bigger overview for Family Teams? I was just telling you, prior to jumping into the interview, I was interviewing Brad Cooper, who's a mutual friend, and he had mentioned Family Teams. I had never heard of it. He said their family follows it, what you guys do, to a T. And so I looked it up, and my wife and I bought your book, bought the family planning calendar, basically bought everything that you guys produce, and have been hook, line, and sinker since. And it's really been transformational for our family. So I can't wait to dive into this. But can you just talk a little bit more about what you guys do at Family Teams?
Yeah. So Family Teams is an interesting organization. It's really attempting to restore the biblical blueprint of family. And one of the observations we've made is that as the culture has redefined family, the church has sort of gone along with the culture's redefinition. So the current sort of cultural definition of a good family is a springboard for individual success. Mm-hmm. And so that you've really built a great family when your kids are launched out and they're doing healthy and well, and they're off on their own and they hit the reset button every generation. So that's kind of our idea of a good family, kind of in a Western culture. And that idea of family, you won't find anywhere in scripture. In fact, it's a very, very new idea. And throughout the world and classical cultures, and certainly throughout the pages of the scriptures, a way of thinking about how the Bible defines family is a multi-generational team on mission. So its primary goal isn't necessarily to launch out individuals and hit the reset button every generation, but it's to build a multi-generational family line. And it's to work together as a team across generations for the mission. Of course, the mission now is to make disciples and spread the gospel. But I think that the idea that family is really just there for the individual success of each of its members has been incredibly toxic. And it's been a experiment that has terribly backfired, and all the statistics on family that you want to look into where this idea of family is being followed really demonstrate that it really it's not compatible with the original design of family. And so family teams is really number one, trying to get the word out about that. Hey, there's a choice. How do you want to build a family? What do you think a family is? But if you want to build a multi-generational team on mission, then you need to be re-equipped. And so all of family teams is really trying to give all the tools that multi-generational family teams need to make the transition.
Yeah. And like I said, when I read Family Revision, your book totally blew my mind, because again, that is our culture, and it's so normal that it's just all about the individual. Yeah. And my wife and I would say are still, you know, we're just getting into your content. We're about 6 months in to transforming our family. But yeah, like you said, we have to be totally re-equipped and change everything we thought about family before. And so if this is a podcast for leaders, and so, you know, what advice do you have for parents who this may be a totally revolutionary idea? Where can they start to actually start leading their family team?
Yeah, well, I think really you have to figure out what you believe about family. Ideas matter. Ideas have consequences. And if you have a bad idea of family, it's sort of like a bad software program running your mind, then everything you're going to build is going to be designed around that blueprint. So I really think the first step is to kind of unlearn or relearn. That's the reason why I call the book Family Revision. It's like you have to revise and create a new vision for what you think family is. And so that requires a little bit of, you know, thought, research. That's why I wrote the book. We have, you know, some introductory podcasts as well, if you prefer to get that in kind of an audio form. We have a button on our website at familyteams.com called Start Here, which kind of walk people through kind of the paradigm transition. But it's really important that very quickly into this transition is if you decide to build a multi-generational team on mission, if that's the kind of family you decide that you want, then I really think you have to bring online tools very quickly, because every tool in our culture is designed to build our family as a collection of individuals. And so if you're going to try to do this, you got to find new tools. And so we also have like a conference we do in different parts of the country because of COVID. It's going online, and we got it coming in December. But it's where we really give you what we think of as the three most sort of foundational tools for family teams. And their team time table is kind of the way we think about it. So team, you write a family mission statement and some family values. You know, time, you really rethink the way you design family life around family rhythms. And then table, probably the easiest, the quickest, and one of the most accessible tools you can implement is crafting a weekly family meal that's designed to help every member of the family experience their family-ness, you know, their what it means to be a son or a daughter, a father, a mother, grandfather, a multi-generational family meal that, you know, as your kids grow up and you have grandkids, this is the weekly sort of gathering point for the family team. That is a really awesome tool that a lot of people dive into first. So that's kind of the way we talk about making the transition.
Yeah. And specifically, I want to dive into the table first, because this has been huge. Like, yeah. You know, we as a family have always had dinner together pretty much every night, but the intentionality that you put into your weekly dinner and the weekly Sabbath, like, I just want to dive into and have you share what you guys actually do. Partially because I've been trying to copy everything you do. I listened to, I think your daughter did a podcast, well, two of your daughters, and yeah. Listening to their experience as kids on how they experience those nights with your family. You know, I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old girl, and, you know, I'm like, man, if this is the way that my girls, you know, 20 years from now, talk about their experience, like, I mean, it just brings me to tears. So can you just talk about what that looks like in your family and what it's looked like over the years?
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, so you mentioned the way we do our family meal is really a kickoff to our Sabbath. And that's an option. A lot of people choose to do that as well. Definitely can do like the Sunday lunch, if that's kind of much more convenient and fits your family culture better. I don't think there's any rules around this. But our family has spent a lot of time in Israel, and so we got very excited about the idea of a Sabbath dinner. So in Jewish culture, the Sabbath begins at sundown, the night before the Sabbath. And so for some Christians, they keep a Sabbath on Sunday. And so that would mean their meal or the Sabbath would kick off Saturday night if they keep it in that kind of evening to evening way. For our family, we did that for about 7 years. And in the beginning stages, it was really, really simple. I mean, when you're starting new rhythms, you don't want to get overwhelmed. Sustainability is important. So when we had little kids, we were just like, what kind of meal would be so easy and so fun and so life-giving that we just would do it over and over again? So it started out with paper plates, you know, real basic stuff. A candle we would light, we'd say a couple of blessings, we'd eat this meal together. And then we kept upgrading it. You know, then we added like, sparkling grape juice, you know, like the kids were like, of course, then when you start to like lose the rhythm, your kids are like, what's that thing we do with the sparkling grape? You know, so your kids start holding you accountable. And then after, you know, a number of months, we decided we wanted this to be, you know, a little more formal. So I went out and bought a special candle, special scent. I also bought, you know, some special dishes that were on sale for almost nothing at some store somewhere, but they made them different, you know? Hmm. So we got those out. And so it started just kind of slowly evolving. About 7 years into it, we switched to Friday night, and did our Sabbath day or day of rest on Saturday. And so, and then we started involving one side of the family every month. Then we started, you know, involving, you know, as we got better and better at hosting these meals and they got more and more life-giving, we just kept on growing them. Now, today it looks quite a bit different. So we've got, you know, 5 kids, you know, some adults in the house now. My daughter, Kelsey, she's 21, all the way down to 12. Both sides of our parents started coming every week. My aunt, my kid's great aunt, and other family members, extended family. My nephew comes every week. My sister comes a lot of times with her partner and lots of people. So we have a large family. We invite other guests. So we have 15 to 20. It's kind of more of a formal meal. So the way we kick it off, I have like a little Sabbath reflection that I say at the beginning. Then we have we sing a song, we light a candle. My wife, you know, does a blessing of the Lord over the candle. Then we, the oldest members of the family will bless the sons, you know, oldest sort of patriarchs of my dad typically. And then also the oldest woman in the family will bless all the daughters. Then we have this meal. It's really fun, relaxed. The kids help us. We do like this crazy dance party at the end where they clean up. Then we have like
just real quick there. Is it that, yeah. I think there was a link in one of the courses I took with you. There's like a 5 minute song on YouTube. I think it's just called Shabbat Shalom. Is that yes. The song you guys dance to?
Oh, it changes, you know, because of course you get sick of songs, but yeah, I love that one. That guy drops a really, really good beat in that song. And so it's really, it's really fun to clean the dishes to that one. And
my daughters go wild. We play that every week and we just love it. And actually my 2-year-old can't say Shabbat Shalom. So she says Shabbat Shabum. And it's just so much fun. So we have a blast. Sorry to interrupt, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys dance and have fun.
And then we just hang out and, you know, we usually build a fire outside or inside, depending on what's going on, have a dessert, you know, and it's just really, it's really fun, really relaxing. We do a lot of reflecting on our family story on our Shabbats. So like tonight is a Shabbat and my youngest daughter, Kyra, is turning 12. And so it's her big, you know, Shabbat night. And so we have a birthday Shabbat, which probably about 20% of them at this point, when we ding, you kind of during the meal, you ding your glass and then somebody says something about whoever and we all toast to whatever that thing is, you know, so whatever Kyra's into or whatever kind of character traits are coming out of her. So we do that. Another thing that happens a lot of times is the elder generation tells family stories. Mm-hmm. So like last Shabbat, my mom, you know, it was around the time of my grandmother's birthday. She died, you know, over 20 years ago. But of course my mom is still grieving the loss of her mother, and wants to share stories. And so she did a whole slideshow presentation for our family after our dinner, wow. Where we talked about what this woman meant to our family, which she was extremely devout believer and had a huge impact on me, and in our family line. And so we want to remember her. We want our kids to see pictures. We want our kids to really understand the story, where they came from, that they have deep roots in the faith, and deep roots in this family. So, so that kind of stuff happens all the time on our Sabbaths.
Yeah. I'm just curious for the blessings. Cause I think you guys just Google, maybe your daughter said you guys just Google the blessing. It's pretty similar. I guess I don't have enough context, but is it a different blessing every time? Is it the same blessing that the matriarch and patriarch, how they bless the children? I'm just curious.
Yeah, we definitely leave it open-ended, but they tend to like the one I wrote, and I took, you know, part of it from a traditional Jewish blessing and then just kind of added an end to it. So like over the sons, we say, may the Lord make you like Ephraim and Manasseh, which is a traditional blessing that comes from Genesis 48. And then we say, may he give you the faith of Abraham, the heart of David, and the righteousness of Christ as you build our family from generation to generation. So really want them to feel you're a part of something that has been going on for thousands of years. This family line has gone, you know, all of our family lines go all the way back, right? And that what you're, and so the sense that you're getting is that you're a part of this long line that Christ has redeemed. So similarly, over the daughters, we say, may the Lord make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, and may he give you the heart of Ruth, the faith of Mary, and the righteousness of Christ as you build our family from generation to generation. So those are the two blessings we wrote. People are free to steal those. We stole half of those blessings as well. And also just, you know, we also say about every blessing and anything we do, anyone can feel free to riff, you know. There's no legalism about Shabbat for us. Where it's all in enjoyment and a gift. And so whatever you want to do, feel free. We'd love for you to put your stamp on it.
Yeah, and you mentioned Sabbath too, that this often is the precursor to your Sabbath. What does Sabbath look like for your family? I mean, Sabbath is something our family did not implement until this year, and it's been life-changing. But I'm just curious, you know, as far as your family team, what do your Sabbaths look like?
Yeah, so the goal is to try to, I call it finding your off button. And one of the biggest misconceptions about having a Sabbath day is that that it's easy to rest, but it actually takes work to rest. It's not, you know, so people just think all you do is just stop working, you know, but after about an hour, you like start looking around saying, okay, what do I do now? like you actually, we're weird kind of creatures and we need, you know, we need to focus our attention in productive ways. And a lot of us don't know how to fully recover if given, you know, full 24 hours of rest. So it's a journey. And for us, it's been a journey for each of our kids, for our family as a whole, what is going to cause us to really rest. And so the way that I've approached crafting a day of rest is I break out the day of rest into four or five chunks. So obviously there's the Friday night chunk, which I spend just hanging out with the family and, you know, having that chill time with them. And, you know, usually that leads right into going to sleep. Then there's a Saturday morning chunk. And for me, you know, that looks very much like, you know, a cup of coffee, going for a long walk, spending a lot of time with the Lord, you know, journaling, prayer, you know, and usually around 10 or 11 o'clock, I want to hang out with one of my family members. I'm very introverted, so that really charges me up. And then I usually take one of my kids, or April and I will go out to breakfast, you know, to kind of a brunch. When our kids were little, sometimes we do this, you know, with the whole family, all the kids, we go out to a brunch. We had a couple of restaurants that were really kid friendly that we like to do that too. And then we get home around one and then just kind of relax for another couple of hours. When our kids were little, again, we'd usually do some kind of outdoor activity after that. Now that our kids are older and they all have their own rhythms that are really restful to them. And I tend to spend that time, you know, again, reading, kind of doing something that's more recharging for me. And then usually I grab one of my kids and do a one-on-one around two or three. I take them out to like ice cream or something. I'll go to a park. And then around 5 or 6 o'clock, I usually take a nap after that. And 5 or 6 o'clock, me and April will go out for our date night. Our kids all have game night with Papa. My dad loves board games. So he's crafted this whole Saturday night, you know, with crazy snacks. And, and so they all play this epic board games while April and I are out for a date night. That's what it looks like now. Again, when our kids were little, it looked very different. You know, we had, you know, as soon as we could, we would have, you know, whatever cereal stuff out so that we didn't have to be constantly. Sometimes we had seasons where we do with the big pancake breakfast. You know, we tried lots of things. And as our kids went through stages, we just kept asking these questions. You know, what worked, what was life-giving, what felt like work, you know, and how could we tweak it? And so that's what ours look like now. You know, when our kids were really little, April would always leave for about 3 or 4 hours every Sabbath. And I would take over the kids, and I found ways to like keep them somewhat occupied while I could rest. But I wanted her to have like a really big break. But yeah, now our kids take care of themselves. There's no diapers. And so a lot easier. But breaking it up into those segments and then constantly having the expectation that it's going to take time to find your off button, and really having consistent conversations about what's working, what to try again, what to like change. That's how I think most people can, you know, over the course of several months, find a Sabbath rhythm that really is life-giving for their family at the stage that they're in. But don't think it's easy, because it is difficult to figure out how to really take a family through a whole day of rest where everyone's like really rested and had a good time.
This is so good. And I can't speak enough about how life-giving this whole practice has been to my family. So again, just thank you so much for your ministry. Yeah. You've mentioned several times the importance of rhythm. And I know you guys are really big on a 7-day rhythm. Can you just talk to us about rhythms and why it's important and what families can do about it?
Yeah, well, you guys know that in our culture, families are very burnt out. There's a huge problem that families have with, you know, just feeling completely overwhelmed. A lot of times when people even find out about the family teams concept, it feels almost like a whole nother project, you know, and they're always like, oh my gosh, I'm already underwater. We're already trying to figure out how to survive. You know, now it feels like there's more things we want to add to our routine. You know, how do we do this in a way that doesn't totally overwhelm our family? So one of the things that we need to begin to have is a constraint on the framework for how to design and how to order our lives. Like, what's the best framework for creating that? Because what we tend to do, especially in Christian culture, is just heap more obligations on people. Why aren't you serving the poor? Why aren't you doing evangelism? Are you discipling? Why aren't you showing up to church at least 3 times a week? You know, why aren't you blah, 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 like fill in the blank, spend more time with your kids, go on date nights. I mean, how does anyone keep up with all these expectations? And that's, but we don't tend to give people a framework or a way to actually succeed at balancing all of the demands of their life in a way that is actually sustainable. And so the framework, I believe, that has been divinely given to us, and it's been told to us multiple times in the scriptures, is the week. We don't design our rhythms around a day or a month or a year or just endless activities or going after some giant goal. We craft a week. God's given us 7 days to live a good life. And so if you can figure out how to maturely steward a 7-day cycle, you can live a great life. You can accomplish whatever the things that God's given you. You can steward the things he's given you. We all have the same amount of time. And so learning how to manage a week and living into a 7-day rhythm, I think really does help families figure out and make those hard trade-off decisions, because you can't do everything in a week. And so you have to let some things go. You have to really double down and make some things succeed. And so part of what we try to train people to do, and we have a course called the 7-Day Family, is to how do you begin to do that? You know, how do you begin to live into 7 days? And that's for us as well. It's been just really life-giving, and it's allowed us to push into so many things together as a team without burning out.
Yeah. And I know that you guys have also produced a family planner that's in a weekly rhythm, which has been so helpful. My wife and I now have weekly team meetings, which is awesome. We used to call them staff meetings. So team meetings, nice. that language alone was very helpful. Yeah. But I'm just curious, what do your family meetings look like as a family?
Yeah. So we do a family meeting every week at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday. And we start with highs and lows. And so everyone goes around, and one of the things I want to train my kids to do during that time is really listen. Like, when somebody says something that surprises you, like, oh, I didn't know you liked that much. Or, so what was your biggest high this last week? What was your biggest, you know, low? Let's really talk about what's going on. And so we listen to each other. That takes about, you know, 15 minutes at least, or just kind of reviewing last week. And then we go into this thing. I have an acronym, CAV, C-A-V. So the C stands for the calendar. So we just like, what's coming up the next 2 or 3 weeks? You know, what do we have on the calendar? That sort of like elicits announcements. So it's like, what didn't you guys know about? Oh, let me tell you, this is what's going on in our, one of our businesses, or this is what's going on in our schedule. These people are coming into town. This is what we want to host. Always naturally leads into conversation about vision. So there's a lot of times, will there something on the calendar? And it's like, one of the things we don't want to do is just, kind of be tyrants over our kids. Like, we want our kids to be excited and to understand the why behind everything we're doing as a family. But a lot of times we don't take the time to really cast a vision. And so what happens inevitably every week is that there'll be something on the calendar and you look around the room and you'll see some confusion. You might even hear somebody like, maybe like, really, why are we doing that? You know, maybe like not excitement or energy around it. And so April will always look over me and say, okay, I think you need to cast a vision about this. I'm like, okay, guys, let me tell you why we're doing this. And, you know, and you can push back if you don't think this is a good reason or this isn't a good trade-off we're making. But you don't really understand the bigger story behind this. So this is just opportunity for me to do a lot of vision casting. This is why this is really consistent with where we're headed as a family. This is why it fits into some of our, you know, our pillars, our values as a family. So we have highs and lows. Then we do calendar announcement, vision. And the last thing we do in our family meeting is, what's one big improvement? What's one area of improvement that we can try to make this week as a family? The way that conversation always starts is really simple. I just turn to April and say, what's not working? Like, what broke this week? Wow. You know, was the kitchen a mess, or was kids leaving things out, or was it attitude issues, or whatever's going on? Like, what is breaking our family right now? And so then we present, so we try to really tease out the problem as well as we can, identify it together. Like, this is the problem. Then we go from that to brainstorming solutions. We really want the kids to have ownership over, you know, what those solutions could look like. We have older kids. And so this, you know, they're much more involved in this process now than they were when they were little. And so oftentimes we'll even create rewards or ways of kind of keeping track of this improvement. But we'll try to define the solution and really lean into it for a week. And then we'll check on it again next week and see if that worked. Did that fix the problem? Are we making progress? Was that a disaster? Do we need to start over? You know, and so this process, which I think actually comes from, the agile world of software development. I guess this is where I first heard this idea of really the one improvement in the meeting a week. This has been, you know, you can imagine what happens over, you know, you do 200 or 300 of those cycles, you know, over several years. You solve so many of these pesky problems, that your family just starts to thrive. Because a lot of times we don't understand, you know, that families, these problems, many family problems are just the accumulation of broken systems or things that have not really been thought about. And you get 20 or 30 of those going and you just feel like your family's a mess, which is understandable, and you can't solve all those things at once. But man, over a year of solving one a week or one every 2 or 3 weeks even, you will make such incredible traction against those things that you will start to see the ship just righting itself. So those are the three things we do during our family meeting.
That's huge. I've not asked that last question. So that'll be a fun family meeting this week. And hopefully we'll get 200 or 300 of those under our belt and be fully functional.
That's right.
So thank you for sharing that. And the last thing you mentioned was vision and the importance of getting away and crafting a family vision, the culture you want to create. And so can you just talk about that process and how you can create that culture that you want in your family?
Yeah. So if you're seeing family as a multi-generational team on mission, you have to articulate the mission. A lot of times people look at this and they're a little bit worried that we're talking about family as mission. In other words, sometimes when people get excited about family, they become very inward. It's all about them. It's not about the gospel. It's not about reaching the world. It's not about serving others. It's about what's going on inside of our family. That's called family as mission. But what we believe is family on mission, that your kids need to, their energies need to be pushed out of the family, but you need to do that together as a team. So in order to do that, you have to say, well, what are the big goals of the family? What are the big assignments the Lord is giving our family? And can we articulate some of those things? And sometimes those are things that, you know, a husband or a wife may have that the Lord's given them that they're working on and that they want to, this is a team thing. That God's called all of us to this. It could also be as your kids are getting older, it'd be clear that there are assignments or things that they're on. And so calling those things out, we do a lot of that conversation through an annual summit that we do as a family. So we go away for 2 or 3 days, you know, after the first of the year and just talk, you know, in detail about how are we doing, you know, with our different assignments, with our family mission, with our values. Is the Lord bringing other things into our family? How are you guys doing? Are you excited and passionate about these things? Has God given you other assignments that we should be helping you or working together as a team to accomplish? And so we want the Lord to give us more and more opportunities to seek the kingdom together as a family. And you know, you see this, of course, process always being done in corporate settings, at businesses and churches and nonprofits. They all have missions, but few people think about families as having mission, which is ironic because in Genesis 1, when God had the first mission, which was, you know, to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it and to rule, he gave that to a family, didn't create a nonprofit, didn't create a business. He created a family to accomplish that mission. And so we need to understand that families, as well as organizations, need missions. And so it takes some time and thought and reflection and, you know, maybe some time to an offsite, kind of what you do even in a organizational setting to figure that out as a family.
Yeah. And I imagine when your kids were younger, was it just you and your wife getting away, or did you include them even when they were little?
Yeah. When they were really little, it was just me and my wife. And we definitely wanted to talk to them about it, introduce them to what we felt like the Lord was calling us. And then as they got older, you know, 8, 9, 10, they started becoming more and more a part of those conversations. And then, you know, at this point, it just, you know, we're all together as a team talking about this stuff. And our goal too, you guys, is, man, when things are, we were so excited about, you know, the transition of having, you know, in-laws, new family members, where we get to, they're bringing their ideas, their missions, their callings into the family team that we're able to help and propel those things they're able to help propel. Like, this is the way I think it's supposed to work. And so, so a lot of times when we look at the little kid stage, you know, you're really stewarding what you and your wife or you and your husband can really handle or figure out together as a team, in terms of those conversations. But that's a very short season, right? Most of your life's going to be spent, your team's just going to keep multiplying, growing, as your kids get married and have kids and, you know, this thing becomes multi-generational.
Yeah. I have to ask you, you have 5 kids. So I think me and my wife are pretty committed to 3 kids, prior to like connecting with your ministry. But after reading your book, I'm like, we got to have like 100 kids. I mean, I'm exaggerated, but I think we're at least committed to 4 now. You know, when you had this paradigm shift of what family looks like, did that increase the amount of kids you wanted to have? That might be too personal of a question, but I'm just
No, curious. Not at all. Totally. Me and my wife are both not kid people. So if we were typical modern Western, maybe we would have 2 kids, you know, for me, especially. Like, neither of us are wired that way. Neither of us like serve in children's ministry or elementary education or any of that stuff. Like we are both like kind of entrepreneurial business leaders. We're much more into that kind of stuff. So yeah, our family size is completely, a result of our belief about family. Like, we think kids are incredible. We see the little kid stage is not the end of parenting, but the beginning of the building of the family team. And so we couldn't think of a more strategic investment than having lots of kids, you know, because we had all C-sections, we had to stop at 5, but we probably would have kept going if we could have. Wow. So yeah, that's what I mean by ideas matter. People think that they're making these decisions sort of purely based on, you know, their own ideas, but they're really, like you just described, Doug, like they're really based on your ideas about family. Yeah. And if you change your ideas about family, then it has a cascade effect on everything else.
Oh, if God blesses us with 4, I'll make sure the 4th calls you at some point and thanks you that they're here because of your ministry. So it's interesting. You said you weren't children people, but I am curious, you know, once you set that vision, you know, you have to train your kids. And, you know, my kids are 2 and 4. We have our number 3 on the way. Can you talk about training and discipline? I'm just curious specifically. Well, I'd be curious in all ages, but I'm specifically interested right now, you know, in the toddler age. How did you train and discipline your kids and your family team?
Yeah. Yeah. I did really learn to love that stage. Cause I think that kids between the age of about 18 months to about 12 years old, there's a beautiful stage in there where kids respond so well to well-designed, systems of training. And so that's, I really poured myself into that. Try to really learn all the ways of doing that. And, you know, Jeff Bethke and I have a course called The Skill of Fatherhood, where I break it down in lots and lots of detail exactly how. But the basic idea, the first thing to understand is that this responsibility of training is the primary thing that is told and given to the father of the family. It says in, you know, when Paul had one thing to say to fathers in Ephesians, where he's going through the whole family, this is what he wanted to say to husbands, to wives, you know, to children. But he got to fathers and he said, fathers, train your children in the instruction of the Lord and do not exasperate them, which is that the most important thing you could say to a father who's raising children at that stage from 18 months to 12 years. And so in that stage, we created training systems. And so the way that I think about a training system, it has to have three components. It's got to have a discipline, a correction, and a reward. And then you have those are your tools for getting your kids' attention on whatever you're training them to do. And then you go ahead and train them. And you have to, a lot of times we should expect is a sort of almost a Christian cultural thing of, you know, you just tell your kids what to do and you discipline them if they don't do it. That's not training, right? Mm-hmm. It starts with like, okay, you got to clearly articulate what you want your child to do. You don't want me to come when you call? Do you want me to stop when I say no? Do you need to be able to sit here, you know, in this blanket for up to 10 minutes? Like that takes time and training. Like you got to invest time, and especially as the father, you got to sit down with each of your kids and do drills and work them through the process of learning how to do all the things you want them to do. And this is super fun. Like this should not be like this annoying process. This is like, great, we're going to spend about, when I get home, I'm going to spend about 10 minutes training you in a new skill that I want you to learn. Wow. And there's going to be a huge reward, or, you know, which, you know, huge to them could be just something as simple as a treat, or even when they're really little, just like, you know, loud praise. Yay, you know, you did it. And so when our kids got a little bit older, past the age of about 4, we had a system called the marble system. And it both helps us create, it really helps us with that really pesky category of training, which is a correction. If you guys are wondering, like, so we think about reward, correction, and discipline. Every job that we expect an adult to do always has all three. So if you go get a job, your reward is you get a paycheck. Your correction is anytime somebody sort of pulls you aside and says, hey, this is how I want you to do that. Not that way, this way. And we all know there's discipline. You can get fired. You get written up. There's some serious. And so we don't expect an adult at any stage of maturity to do any job without having all three of those intact. But we expect a 2-year-old to be able to perfectly, you know, perform whatever kind of thing that we expect them to do without anything but a discipline. Wow. That's the first thing is it's like, we don't understand that our expectations are really out of whack when it comes to how we're bringing up children. So you have to have a system that has all three. So for us, what we did was we had a marble system for our kids. Again, about 4 or 5 is when this starts to work really well. There's something we're training them in, you know, that we don't want you to leave your shoes out when you walk in the door. We want you to, you know, help every time we leave with your, you know, your baby sibling or whatever the things that you're worried about, you're thinking about, things that you want to praise them for. Every time they do it, just really awesome. That's so good. Put a marble in your bowl. Or thank you for, you know, you're answering. Yes. What can I do to help? Put a marble in your, so you're constantly rewarding them to get the 10 marbles. You take them out for ice cream or you get them a book or, you know, some kind of toy. You have, that's currency. And so you really want to protect that currency. If they don't do what you've trained them to do, again, the assumption is you've already articulated, you've already kind of taken them through, you know, 10 or 15 minutes worth of drills over the course of maybe a week. You know, they know what it's, how to tie their shoes or where to put their shoes or, you know, how to clear their plate or whatever it is. Then you say, okay, you didn't do it. Take a marble out of your bowl. You know, simple correction, not a big deal, not a big discipline. It's just like, hey, that's, you know how to do that, right? And you know, we trained you to do that and you could have earned a marble had you done that, but you didn't do it. So, you know, so we had a system like that. And then discipline was not about the marble system. You know, whatever we would do for discipline would be something else, because we wanted to really protect that. It's like almost all positive. The correction was a little bit negative, but it wasn't very serious. And our kids took that really well. So that's the system. If you use corrections a lot, you're doing a lot of good training. Discipline is fairly rare, you know, and that was very much what we experienced. It wasn't a huge part of our development because we took a lot of responsibility for training our kids, for rewarding them, and for correcting them. But certainly, I think there does need to be a backstop of discipline when your child will not pay attention to the training you're doing, or, you know, so they understand that there is a step, below even the correction. And so there's lots of sort of age appropriate ways to think about discipline. And so, and in our course, we have tons of different examples of each stage and lots of those. And obviously that's something that parents need to figure out what they feel comfortable with. You know, for us, there was, you know, whether it's like a little hand smack when they're really little, you know, we would certainly do like different kinds of timeouts. And you know, take things away, or, you know, things that they really wanted. There are lots of different ones like that. When they're really little, I did, my favorite discipline was sort of just grabbing their little cheeks and just like really getting their attention and saying no, you know, really loudly and clearly. And so they're just like, you know, kind of startled at first. And then, you know, they might be a little upset, but that's the kind of thing. It's really about attention. You want to, needs to be very immediate. The younger the kids are, the more the discipline has to be very much tied to whatever behavior you're really trying to help them come out of. And I really think of this process of training as a skill, not as something, again, like we should all expect that we're really good at just because we're people. There's a skill to training children, and it's something that we need to learn. There's lots and lots of tools. Don't get hung up if there's a tool you've heard of that you're like, I don't want to use that. That's fine. There's 1,000 other ones. But the fact is, especially for fathers, we need to be training our kids. We need to be having tools that are effective. And it makes a huge difference in the life of a family to have trained children.
Jeremy, this has been so good. And if you're listening to this, I just want to encourage you again. You may be hearing all this and say, wow, that sounds overwhelming. I really encourage you, like you said, go to familyteams.com. There's a link that says start here. Literally, that's all I did when I heard Brad talk about Family Teams. My wife and I bought the book Family Revision. We read it together, and we just started implementing some of the things Jeremy and his ministry Jeremy's talked about in this podcast. And I just can't encourage you enough. Get this book, connect with Family Teams. And Jeremy, before we dive into the lightning round, which is more leadership questions just for fun, anything else you want to leave leaders with when it comes to leading their family teams today?
Well, I think that probably the biggest concern I have for leaders is that they would see themselves primarily as the head of their organization in a way that they don't see themselves as a head of their family. So one of the things I really talk to fathers and mothers, but especially dads that tend to do this a lot more, is that when you go to work, when you lead your organization, see yourself as the head of a family. Never take your father hat off ever. See that as sort of an umbrella hat in which you wear. So if you're going out to change the world, say, I'm doing it as a representative of my family. I am right now the leader of the prior family, and I am leading this organization on behalf of my family. And so when you start to think that way, you don't think about, work as being something separated from your family. You see it as an expression of your family. And then what you really start to wonder is, well, then how can I integrate my family into this? Because I'm saying I'm doing this as a representative of my family, and my kids never see my work. My wife is never a part of what I do at work. Everything's totally disintegrated. Everything is separated. That doesn't feel consistent. And so it starts with, I'm a father everywhere I go. Every time I'm leading as the father of my family. I'm constantly trying to integrate my family into whatever assignments or activities I'm doing. But that is especially important for leaders, because you can set that tone for whatever organization you're a part of. And that begins to allow those who are following you, other staff members, to likewise begin to see their work in that organization as a, not just a representative of your organization, but as a representative of your family. This is, to me, one of the greatest tragedies of the Industrial Revolution was the decision to completely separate work from family. Up to that point, throughout human history, work was a fully integrated part of family. Ministry was a fully integrated part of family. That really happened because, we began to create places, people left farms, they left trades, they left sort of their small parishes or whatever, and they began to become a part of much larger industrial-sized systems. And when they did that, we discovered that it was actually is useful for those large organizations to sort of separate you from your family and use you as sort of a small part of this larger machine. And by doing that, we've really created this unfortunate divide between family and work. And I think we got to heal that divide. That's really been bad for families, and it's really been bad for moms and dads when they go to work, because oftentimes what they're essentially doing over time is they're switching teams. They don't see themselves primarily as the leader of their team, or their life is primarily an expression of their leadership of their family, but they see their life as really an expression of in and through this organization. And that is one of the things that tears families apart. So reintegrating that, I think, is really important, especially for leaders.
It's amazing. Well, Jeremy, with the time we have left, I want to dive into the lightning round. Just a bunch of fun questions. I love asking leaders at the end of every interview. And the first one is, what is the best advice you've ever received, and who gave it to you?
The best? Man. Well, I think probably the one that changed my life the most was when I was in 10th grade, a man who discipled me named Ed Kelly taught me that Jesus is Lord is a lifelong decision that I had to make, and a confession I had to, as a kid growing up in Christian family, I didn't realize I had to do. So just work through the process. Do you believe Jesus is Lord? When I worked through that process and made that confession, even as somebody who saw himself as a Christian, I really think that was a completely different moment for me. That's when I really, my faith came alive. And this phrase, Jesus is Lord, and understanding the Lordship of Christ, is something that I think that was so clearly central to the way the early church thought. And I think that if you haven't gone through that process of really considering the cost of making that confession and then making that confession, I would encourage you to do that, even as somebody who might be in Christian ministry. A lot of us just haven't really thought through that in that way. But it completely changed my life. So that would probably be the most important advice I ever heard.
If you could put a quote on a billboard for everyone to read, what would it say?
A quote on a billboard? Man, it's hard to say something that pithily on the spot. So probably something related to family. I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase, you know, the way that I talk about that ancient wisdom heals the modern family. I think that there's a verse in Jeremiah that for me it was sort of like a billboard verse that's really impacted me, where he said, "Stand at the crossroads and look, ask for the ancient paths, and walk in them so that you can find rest for your souls." And so I would say, you know, sometimes the best thing to do when you're on the wrong road is to look back, not always just to innovate. And we live in an innovation saturated culture. So I'd probably put that verse on it. Stand, look, you know, ask for the ancient paths and walk in those, and you'll find rest for your souls.
What's the best purchase you've made in the last year for $100 or less?
Man, best purchase. I can't think of anything more valuable that I purchased for $100 or less than Audible credits.
There we go.
So I'm obsessively on there, and I take, you know, I don't know if you guys have heard of it, like there's a thing on there called the great courses, and they just keep getting better and better.
Yeah.
I took a course on US history that's 42 hours long that costs like $10, I guess, or one Audible credit. And, you know, I was sort of like mouth on the floor the whole 42 hours.
Really?
This, you know, there's so many like that, but it was so many times better than any college course that I'd ever taken on, and I took, you know, a bunch of history courses in college. Nothing anywhere close to the quality of what I was listening to for $10 on, you know, while I was working out or driving the car. And I'm so grateful, honestly, as somebody who just consumes a ridiculous amount of content to be alive right now, because there is so much good content. And I'm just thoroughly, but in terms of value, I can't imagine. What did I pay for that college course? I think the average history course in a state university costs, I think it was, I heard one estimate that it's about, you know, if you have about 500 people in the course, it's almost $10 million that they have to spend on that one course in terms of everyone's college tuition. And, you know, we can get these things for $10. So that's a pretty big ROI.
I mean, that probably rolls right into my next question, but just, you know, what are one or two of the books that have impacted you the most in your life?
Man. I've been impacted lately by, I mean, Francis Chan's book, Letters to the Church, really summarized a lot of things that I've definitely been thinking about a lot lately that has been impacting me. I'm just looking at my Audible. I think I've got 700 books in here that are, my favorite book of all time is the Silmarillion, Tolkien's mythology. One of the things I think a lot of people don't understand is that so many things are articulated in mythology before we can really talk about them in sort of normal language. And if you can learn from mythology, there's nothing better than getting down to first principles in terms of thinking. And so that's probably some of my favorite books are basically books I listen to over and over and over again. I want to inhabit some of those great mythological stories and really understand what they're saying about the human condition. But Tolkien's mythology is unique in that it definitely saturated in a Christian worldview. You can see it everywhere. But it's much purer form in the Silmarillion, I feel like, than the Lord of the Rings. So I've read that book probably 20 times.
I see Will shaking his head. He must be excited about that. I never heard of it, but I'll check it out. It's awesome.
Oh, man. Yeah, a lot of people don't like it. To warn you, you have to like mythology. It's sort of like reading the Old Testament of the Lord of the Rings, but I love the Old Testament, and I love that book.
If you could spend time with a great leader or someone that you admire, do you have a favorite go-to question that you always ask?
Well, I certainly want to understand how their family works. And that's always been like, it's difficult for me to really be excited about learning from a leader if I don't have a lot of respect for, you know, kind of their family. Wow. And, but if I do, I can imagine what, you know, that's always what I want to know. Like, I want to see, because one of the problems you guys, every one of us has is, most of us only grown up in one family. We've only seen one model of a father, one model of a mother. And that's a very constraining problem. And so a big thing our family has done is we've let other families, young families, come and live with us for 3 or 6 months at a time. And, you know, and it's a huge invasion of privacy and all of that, you know, but it's, but I really feel like we need lots and lots of models, and I don't want to be the only one for anyone either. But I really want to know, like, there are some, you know, some mentors who've just let me get close to their family, to how they treat their wife, how they treat their kids, how they handle their finances, how they order their house. And I am so indebted to those few leaders who have opened up, you know, those windows to me. And that's real discipleship at a very practical level.
This is huge. And I mean, I'm just going to throw the lightning round out. I am curious on this, because I heard your daughters talk about this too, how they would actually have friends over for Shabbat or for your, you know, weekly family dinner. I didn't know that you allowed families to come into your house for 3 to 6 months. Let me know if I can apply for that. But as a side note, but on a serious note, you know, when you think about friendships that you connect in your community, I mean, do you, as a married couple, is that how, I guess I'm just curious how you invest in other couples. Like, do you have them over for your family dinner, or is that something you do separate? How do you let people see that? Because what you just said was absolutely huge. Because my life, I mean, I would not be where I am if I didn't have other families bring me in and show me another way. Right. And I want to do that. I want to do for others what was done for me. So I just want to hear you talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a big challenge. You definitely don't want to do it if your family is in like hyper survival mode or anything like that. And so when our kids were really little, it was not easy, but, and we did a little bit mostly with singles at that stage, and the singles, you know, one of the first ways to practice this that I encourage a lot of young families to consider, especially like you're saying, Doug, if you start actually having more children, you know, there's a stage of child rearing, which is really hard, you know, physically. And so what we did is, if you have a 3-bedroom house, you have a boys' room, a girls' room, and a guest room. And in that guest room, you want to have a single that your family is investing in discipling. And you make very clear that as an exchange for living in that room, you need 20 hours of their time, you know, to help the family team. So help us with laundry, with diapers, watching the kids, let us go on date nights. And we actually bought houses always with that sort of third room in mind, so that there could be some privacy there. So we practiced this a lot as our kids were little, and it made having 5 kids way easier than you know. Our hardest moment was when we had our third child and didn't have that person living with us. 6 months in, we had a young single guy living with us, and ever since then we did. So that was much easier to handle. It was, you know, that's work to manage that. But then when our kids got a little older, we bought a duplex, and we sort of broke the walls down between the two sides with this vision in mind. And again, it comes down to our definition of what discipleship is. We see a critical element of discipleship is really immersion. You have to see the lifestyle. It's not just going to Starbucks and going through a Bible study. So we have a couple of guest bedrooms over there in the duplex. And so we just invited families to live with us. You know, we did this another time. We did a finished basement once, you know, and had, you know, a little kitchenette down there. And we just would challenge people. Hey, if you're really wanting to grow or understand how these rhythms work, you know, come stay with us for a season. Maybe 3 weeks, maybe 3 months. And so we learned a ton of rules around that make that, you know, really sustainable for us as a family. You know, it's, you know, we have a rule that says one kitchen, one vision, which means that if you only have one kitchen in the house and you have another family living with you, you have to basically integrate almost everything in terms of like rhythms, family meetings. So we actually didn't want to do that over time. We thought that was too invasive on both families. So we, you know, we made sure there was another kitchen next door. So there's a lot of access, but it's not as much as would forced us to really, you know, constantly enmesh our families. So that made it a lot more sustainable for us. Another thing we've learned is that 3 months is about the limit in which things with birth order start to get weird for the kids. That's a really big deal to us. Like, it's really important that our kids experience their family-ness in the birth order that they are. I think there's deep reasons for why that's important.
Do you recommend that? I haven't read that book, the birth order book. Like, do you recommend that?
Yeah, I just think that's a reality, that especially with a larger family. With one or two kids, it may be like, well, what does it matter? But when you start having 4, 5, 6 kids, you really need to understand birth order. And I think when you're trying to create a team dynamic, it's really important as well. Like if the firstborn, there's always going to be a certain responsibilities and certain realities that child is going to face that other children are not, that you need to really understand. But that being said, if you have another family living with you, that can get kind of weird, even if they're younger. And so most of the families that come live with us, they have young kids, and our youngest is 12. So that's kind of the way that we've approached it. And, you know, trying to have a weekly time with that family, integrate them into lots of different rhythms. Like you said, having them over for Shabbats. And we have a much more robust rhythm than just Shabbat. We have, you know, we have various things that we have during the day and the evening, and a Monday and a Tuesday, a Wednesday, a Thursday, all mean something unique to our family. So we wanted them to see the different rhythms and how that's been constructed over the years. And, you know, they can pick and choose what might work for their family, what might not. Again, it's just because I'm concerned about the fact that so many of us are locked into a template, especially those who grew up with non-believing parents. It's like, it's really important that their family is given as much opportunity as possible to thrive. And so wanting to give them, you know, more, and there's lots of families in our community that do similar to us, where, you know, this is just part of the cost of believing that the primary mission of the new covenant is discipleship. And you can see how Jesus made disciples, right? He lived in an immersive lifestyle with 12 other men. And so as a family, like, how are you going to pull that off? You know, I can't go and leave my family and just wander around the countryside with a bunch of my buddies, as much as I think that would be amazing. Right. But I can sort of craft a, you know, sort of an environment in our house that would allow for that kind of immersive discipleship.
Well, Jeremy, this has been unbelievable. I could go for another 2 or 3 hours, so maybe we could do this again in the future. But thank you for investing in Will and I today, and everyone that will listen to this. And again, I've said it probably 5 times already, but thank you just for your ministry. It was a divine appointment for our family, and hopefully we'll be able to take that and multiply it 100-fold for you. So thank you. And again, anything you want to leave leaders with? I know you mentioned there's an online conference coming up in December people can connect with. We'd love to promote that. Anything else you want to leave us with today?
I think I think the one other thing that we do, that probably my favorite thing we do at Family Teams, is for entrepreneurs who are starting, you know, who are trying to figure out how to integrate faith, family, and business. I have a lot of concern or interest for leaders who are leading larger organizations or are who are trying to figure out the integration game, you know, with no models. And so we started a mastermind group, Jefferson Bethke and I, called Integrated. It's a smaller group for guys. It's at familyteams.com/integrated, but particularly for business owners or leaders who are really trying to figure this out, how to integrate faith, family, and business. Check that out, because we get together twice a year for 2.5 days. We do deep dives. I introduce people to, you know, many of my mentors, people in our community. And we have these deep conversations with one another, including monthly calls where we try to hash out how to do this practically. And I just want to walk with certain guys who are struggling with that, because that's where I'm at. That's what I'm really wrestling with, you know, with our family, so that we're doing that together, because there's not a great template for that in our culture. So that's probably the last thing I would throw out there, is something that people might be interested in.
Great. We'll promote that as well. But thanks again, and hopefully we'll get to connect again.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Well, hey, leader, thank you so much for listening to my interview with Jeremy Pryor. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find ways to connect with him and links to everything that we discussed in the show notes at l3leadership.org/266. This episode of the podcast is also brought to you by my friends at Bear Tongue Advisors. The financial advisors at Bear Tongue Advisors help educate and empower their clients to make informed financial decisions. You can find out how Bear Tongue Advisors can help you develop a customized financial plan for your financial future at beartongueadvisors.com. That's BERATUNG advisors.com. Securities and investment products and services offered through Waddell & Reed, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Baritone Advisors, Waddell & Reed, and L3 Leadership are separate entities. And as always, I like to end with every episode with a quote. And being that this was a family leadership podcast, I'll quote Andy Stanley. It's my favorite family quote. He said, "Leaders, the most important thing you may ever do for the kingdom of God may not be something you do, but someone you raise." That is so good. Keep that in mind as you lead your family team. Thanks for listening to this episode, and we will be back with you next time. See ya.